This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Somebody told me they thought the show sounded like the voice of doom the other day, what with all the bad news about inflation or whatever it was. So let's try something different this time. Hey, everybody, did you hear the great news about housing? It's a tiny little bit less terrible. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. And by Clarkson Potters, the Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat. Available now.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us today, everybody. It is the 27th of May, a Tuesday, and here's what we're going to do this afternoon. We're going to tell you something you haven't heard in quite a while now. Good news about the housing market. And then, well, we're going to pull you firmly back down to earth. The news is of new homes. We learned this morning that for the first time in 6 months, sales are up. But that's right about where the housing market gets back to business as we have come to know it, because a separate report today said home prices plunged more than 14% in the first 3 months of the year. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports now on a key part of the economy that just can't seem to get it going again.
It's tempting to see the April sales increase as a sign the market is turning around. Well, don't be too tempted.
It's only an increase because the March figures were revised lower. Otherwise, the April numbers continued to be pretty disappointing.
That's Bankrate.com analyst Greg McBride. For one thing, sales of existing homes dropped last month, and home prices continue to slide. The 14% decline in home prices in the first quarter is 5 times the rate of decline in the last housing downturn. The rise in foreclosures is pushing prices down as more homes sit vacant. A clampdown on mortgage lending is keeping would-be buyers out of the market. Christopher Thornburg is with Beacon Economics. He says home prices had hit such astronomical levels compared to incomes during the housing boom, prices had to come down.
In the long run, this is going to be a good thing for the U.S. economy. In the short run, however, it's very painful. And it's painful because people have been relying on the value of their home to support their spending over the last few years.
Indeed, there's evidence today the housing downturn is weighing on consumers. A business group, the Conference Board, said its Consumer Confidence Index hit its lowest level this month in almost 16 years. Economists say eventually home prices will fall far enough to get people buying again. That's already happening in some hard-hit markets like Detroit. But realtors say nationwide there are enough homes on the market now to last more than 10 months. A 6-month supply is considered healthy. And analysts say the market's got a lot more healing to do. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Shares of Borders Books tumbled almost 7% today. That's probably not the response the company had been hoping for on the day that it reintroduced itself as an online bookstore. You see, for the past 7 years, Borders has been selling books only through Amazon.com. The company had bet that a partnership with the world's biggest internet retailer was the best way to manage the online side of its business. But times and business models change, so as of today, Borders is out on its own, even as the company has announced it's looking into the possibility of selling itself. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite looked into why Borders made the web change now.
Borders has been plotting the launch of its own full-service site ever since its current CEO joined the company 2 years ago, and long before it was considering a sale. Patty Freeman-Evans is a retail analyst with Jupiter Research. She says the new site aims to get more book lovers into the actual stores, where she says most book buying still takes place.
Borders is very aggressively going after a stronger multi-channel experience and feel they are better equipped to do it themselves than with the arrangement with Amazon.
She says the website will include areas like staff picks, a tactic that works well in brick-and-mortar stores. Jim Milliot is Director of Business and News for Publishers Weekly. He says Borders has spent a lot of money on the site, though it won't say how much. He says its success could influence the company's fate.
If it turned out to be a huge disaster and they don't recoup their investment, it could obviously be another factor in forcing them towards a sale. And if it's a huge success, well, it could be a factor in maybe they're wanting to stay independent.
The end of the Borders partnership with Amazon could eat into the online retail giant's profits. But Jupiter's Patty Freeman-Evans says the damage won't be too bad.
Amazon has had record quarters recently, so Amazon has a lot of wind behind it.
She says online sales are predicted to grow strongly in the next few years, so there should be room for both companies to profit. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Today, one of the country's biggest philanthropic organizations did what it does best. It gave away bucketfuls of money. The Howard Hughes Medical Institute says it's going to bankroll 56 scientists. They'll split a pot of more than $600 million for their research. But you'll notice I didn't say what that research is for. That's because it doesn't really matter. Unlike most grants, today's money isn't tied to specific projects. Jeremy Hobson explains it's going to be given to scientists directly, who can then study whatever they want.
The Hughes Institute wants its researchers to go out on a limb. Tom Check is the organization's president.
Often in the course of research, you stumble upon leads to your question that were different from what you originally proposed. And by funding the person, not the project, we are freeing people up to follow those leads.
For example, he says one investigator started out studying retroviruses, but he switched gears and started building miniature arrays to look at the expression of genes in an organism. Don't worry, I have no idea what that means either.
But before long, he was looking at typing various sorts of leukemias and lymphomas and breast cancer. So he moved into the cancer area with tremendous results.
But Kei Koizumi says funding the person instead of the project isn't always a good idea. He heads the R&D Budget and Policy Program at the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
Funding a person does carry a little bit more risk because you don't know, you know, what that person is going to come up with. And of course, that is true if you're funding a research project as well. You're not sure what the result is, but you are at least more sure about what kind of goal you are reaching for.
Koizumi says ideally every funding institution would have a mix of both high and low risk grants, but he says the Hughes money has taken on a new significance because of stagnant funding at the National Institutes of Health, and many scientists say a tighter budget has made the NIH less willing to take risks. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Oil dropped below $129 a barrel today, almost hit $128 in point of fact. Wall Street must have seen that as something of a sign of better things to come, or maybe they were just hoping. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the great families of American business is hoping it's still got some influence more than 125 years after their great-great-grandfather founded what we know today as ExxonMobil. Back then, the company was called Standard Oil, but present-day members of the Rockefeller family want it to move beyond oil. They're sponsoring a shareholder resolution at the annual meeting tomorrow that would force Exxon to split the roles of chairman of the board and CEO, and so perhaps slightly shift the company's focus. Robert Hillman's a professor of law at the University of California, Davis. Professor Hillman, good to have you with us.
Pleasure.
Let's think about what the Rockefellers want to do with this proposal. They're concerned, at least in part, that Mr. Tillerson, the CEO and chairman of ExxonMobil, isn't thinking far enough ahead, perhaps, for this company and investing more in alternative energies, right?
Right.
Do you think this then will make their case any more plain to the public?
Well, it's probably the best way of drawing management's attention to this concern. Shareholders really have no power other than the power to express their opinion through a vote. And management does heed what shareholders are saying if there's sufficient support among the shareholders at the vote.
But they've been trying to do this now for 4, 5, 6, 7 years, the Rockefellers have.
Yes, and they have a fairly significant level of support among the shareholders. Not enough to compel management to implement this proposal, but enough to require management to pay attention to what they're saying.
It's worth a note that even though they're the great-great grandchildren of John D. Rockefeller, who started the company, they are not by any means in control of this company.
Absolutely not. Ownership is spread across tens of thousands of shareholders, and no institution acting by itself is in a position to exercise control in the corporation.
Now, if their names weren't Rockefeller, would you and I be having this conversation?
Probably not.
Yeah, a short way of asking, how successful is shareholder activism like this?
Well, it's not entirely successful if it's measured solely by terms of whether the shareholders are able to get a majority vote behind their proposal. What this kind of proposal is designed to do is put pressure on management, to shine a light on the corporation and attempt to get the corporation to implement these reforms voluntarily.
Well, give me your odds here. What do you think the odds of success might be for the Rockefellers versus ExxonMobil tomorrow? And is that really the point? Maybe it's all about publicity.
It's all about publicity, and it's all about not tomorrow, but next year. And I think that the odds of success tomorrow are not terribly great, but the odds of implementing this proposal over the next 12 to 18 months are fairly good.
What do you think John D. Rockefeller himself would have thought of his descendants taking on the company like this?
Oh, you would have to sit down with John D. Rockefeller and explain quite a bit to him, because we're in different times. It's a different culture for evaluating corporations. If you could wake John D. Rockefeller from the dead and ask him to respond quickly to what's going on, he would not like it.
Robert Hillman is a professor of law at the University of California, Davis. Professor, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hundreds of thousands of earthquake survivors in southwest China have something new to worry about. Emergency workers are scrambling to move them out of the path of what could be a devastating flood. 34 billion gallons of river water have risen behind landslides after the quake that hit 2 weeks ago. The government's hoping to have everybody moved by the end of the day. Overall, the death toll has topped 67,000 people. By one official estimate, 11 million people have been left homeless. So Beijing has been asking for tents, as well as more conventional relief supplies like food and water. And on the home front, China Incorporated has kicked its tent-making industry into overdrive, as our China Bureau Chief Scott Tong reports.
The town of Beichuan near the quake's epicenter lost 9,000 people. Some of the survivors subsist at this refugee camp. Right now, they're lining up for blankets. Each tent sleeps 6 to 10 people, and they'll be living here a while, at least through the hot summer and the long winter. The problem is tent supply. Imagine sheltering the populations of New York City and Chicago combined. Peter Goff coordinates foreign aid groups in Sichuan, desperately seeking tents for the most remote areas.
We're just trying to get into those kind of places and establish sort of tent villages, tent hospitals, tent schools, and so on, just to get people under some kind of cover.
That's where factories like this come in, 1,000 miles to the east. The Shanghai company Yangfan normally makes tents and sleeping bags for brand-name camping companies like Eureka in the United States and Vango in Britain. Right now, though, Yangfan is in the business of disaster relief. That's plant manager Chen Zhixiang.
The day after the quake, government officials called us and asked us to send everything we had. So we worked until 2 in the morning to airlift more than 1,000 tents. Later, they sent us a fax asking us, how many more can you make by June 20th?
The answer, 70,000 tents. Yangfan put its U.S. and European clients on hold, and it shifted hundreds of workers from other product lines over to tent making. Once the fabric comes next week, the plant plans to run from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. In order to motivate its workers, giant wall banners state, we work overtime so the earthquake survivors can return to their lives. Yangfan also offers employees financial incentives. The more you make, the more you make, says sewing machine operator Wang Wei.
We have assembly line races. Whoever makes the most wins prizes. Sometimes it's money. Sometimes it's appliances like washers and dryers and microwave ovens.
Providing housing to earthquake survivors is relief priority number one in China. Almost every day, state media shows President Hu Jintao visiting a tent factory, cheering workers on. Here at Yangfan, 22 workers make up one assembly line. Some cut, some stitch, some adhere waterproofing tape to tent seams. And every 2.5 hours, each worker provides the labor equivalent of one tent. The work is repetitive, monotonous. Which may be why half the employees have earphones on, listening to tunes like this. Almost everyone here is a rural migrant, making around $1 an hour. By the way, each tent bound for Sichuan sells for $193. Sounds pricey, but these are heavy-duty shelters, says Richard Brubaker, a logistics coordinator. He also runs a charity doing earthquake relief.
We're not talking about your weekend away at Tahoe kind of tent. We're talking about your military tent that you would see in military conflict zones and relief zones. These are large kind of MASH hospital tents.
Outside the plant, forklifts and trucks are ready to roll. And a cargo train bound for Sichuan is also on standby. Logistics man Richard Brubaker marvels at China's instant mobilization of industry and infrastructure.
They move so many people and so much assets right away. They commandeered every airplane to make this happen. It's something to kind of stand back and admire, kind of be in awe of, is how fast they're able to go from zero to 60.
It's the benefit of an economy that still retains its central planning roots. In this case, cranking up the world's workshop for disaster relief. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, exploring the new world of talent on the web.
What ideas are going to work, what we're going to do to make them work, and who that client needs to meet with on the buyer side of the business.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 0.5% today, 68 points to close at 12,548. The NASDAQ jumped 1.5%, 36 points to close at 2,481. The S&P 500 climbed 0.2%, 9 points. Ended the day at 1385. It was a healthy day for Apple. Shares of the computer maker rang up almost 3% as investors gear up for the release of the second-generation iPhone. Tech stocks generally were stronger today. Google clicked up 3% and IBM moved 2.5% higher. European banking giant UBS said it's bracing for more write-downs stemming from the subprime crisis. Its stock plunged almost 6% today. Jamba Juice squeezed out a gain of more than 13%. The smoothie chain announced it's teaming up with Nestle in a line of bottled beverages. Markets overseas were kind of mixed. Back home, bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.92%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. And by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. The Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for April. If sparkle is your thing and you've got about $6 million lying around, check out the giant diamond up for auction at Christie's in Hong Kong. At over 101 carats, it's the biggest colorless diamond to go under the hammer in 18 years. After all, diamonds are forever, according to author Ian Fleming. The creator of James Bond was born on May 28, 1908. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Today, the Inter-American Development Bank announced a plan to help poor countries cope with the food crisis, a $500 million line of credit to let them ramp up agricultural production and reinforce some social programs. Commentator and economist Edward Miguel says it's a great example of well-targeted international aid that can do a whole lot more than just fight poverty.
Food prices in the U.S. have been rising fast. Growing demand for food products in Asia and unusual global climate patterns are driving the increase. While higher prices put a moderate dent in our wallets, food shortages have much more severe consequences in Africa, the poorest part of the world. Most African families still rely on farming to make a living, so when the rains fail, their main source of income evaporates. This leaves them dangerously close to the edge of survival, and when people have nothing left to lose, desperation can even lead to violence. Now there's evidence in African countries that a drought in a given year increases the probability that war will erupt the following year, and the impacts are very large. A bad drought can boost conflict risk by 50%. When the crops fail, many young men find that fighting for something to eat beats starving to death in their fields, and the government army, deprived of tax revenue by a stalling economy, is powerless to stop them. Climate change could make things even worse. If drought becomes as common in the 21st century as some leading scientific models predict, the risk of civil war will continue to rise. What can be done about this looming catastrophe? First, Western nations must use foreign aid to stop African conflicts before they start. Aid should act as insurance. We know economic volatility like drought increases the risk of armed violence, so aid donors can identify the countries at greatest risk by tracking the weather. Once they know which countries are experiencing droughts or other major economic shocks, foreign aid could be ramped up quickly to bolster short-run economic conditions. This could head off political instability and violence. Climate change poses economic challenges for the whole world. Nowhere is this threat more dire than for the poorest African farmers that still rely on the weather for their livelihoods. But with some improvements in foreign aid, we can make sure that climate change won't drive Africa further into the vicious cycle of poverty and war.
Edward Miguel is a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. His newest book, Economic Gangsters, Corruption, Violence, and the Poverty of Nations, is set to be released in September. Go to our homepage to share your thoughts with us. It's marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. It's not always the biggest ideas in business that make the biggest splash. For instance, Google didn't actually invent searching on the internet, you know. They just perfected a way to make money from it. But whether ideas turn out to be big or small, smart companies are always looking for them. It might be the new thing that'll eventually turn the world upside down, or maybe it's just a tweak or a twist that'll give them a leg up on the competition. With all of that in mind, we're starting an Every Now and Then series today about those new ideas that we're going to call The Shakeup. Today, a trip out to Hollywood and the United Talent Agency. Yeah, I hear you. What's the big shakeup about a stodgy old economy company like a talent agency? On the face of it, says John Zimelis, not much. Zimelis used to be a literary agent out in Chicago. Today, he's sitting with three other guys in a crowded office that houses the entire staff of United Talent's online division. Zimelis says, online or off, all agents ask the same basic questions.
What ideas are going to work? What we're going to do to make them work, and who that client needs to meet with on the buyer side of the business to be able to further their career and hopefully, in this case, get a little money to produce their next project.
It just so happens that for Zimelis and his colleagues, those new projects are online.
Today, I'm surfing the web.
Jason Nadler's been with UTA Online since it started. That would be all of about a year and a half ago. Nadler's 28. Today he's wearing jeans and a t-shirt, hasn't shaved in a couple of days, which is okay because he spends his days on the web, poking around for things like this.
What if everything you ever wanted came in a rocket can?
Power! Rocket can? Yeah, whatever, right? But here's Nadler's take.
fake commercials really work.
That fake rocket can commercial sure worked to the tune of 6 million hits. It was produced by a Canadian outfit that calls itself Picnic Face. They make videos that show up on sites like collegehumor.com. They're also some of UTA Online's newest clients. Nadler and his crew find the talent behind things like Rocket Can. They line them up with the money people. They take their cut and then get out of the way.
What is the American obsession with prom?
Prom Queen's another great example.
It is going to be the best night of your freaking life. I'm going to teach you every move I know. It is going to change your life.
Prom Queen was an online video micro-murder mystery. Episodes lasted just 90 seconds. But Short was oh so sweet. The first run got 200,000 hits a day. And numbers like that helped UTA sell Prom Queen to a digital production house owned by former Disney CEO Michael Eisner. Jane Hu works for Eisner.
And then we worked with them again for the spinoff show, Prom Queen Summer Heat.
Prom Queen Summer Heat sounds like a bad slasher movie or something.
That's the genre we're going for. It's a teen soap opera meets, I always say it's like Mean Girls meets Carrie.
Online videos aren't really making money yet. Think about it for a second. How do you generate ad revenue for something that's not much longer than an ad itself? But that'll happen soon enough. The research firm eMarketer figures the web video ad market's going to top $4 billion in just a couple of years. UTA Online also represents Jessica Rose. She was Lonely Girl 15, if you remember her, and the directors of the first Obama Girl videos. But if the whole young guys sitting around with computers all day thing sounds familiar to you, it did for me, too. There's a little bit of, just looking around this office, right? I mean, you've got the basketball hoop taped to the big window looking out on the Hollywood Hills. You've got the big double tubs of Bazooka bubblegum and a surfboard out in the lobby I saw. There's a little element of the dot-com boom here, a little bit of that flavor.
Well, we try. I mean, I think that Silicon Valley ethos is very alluring, and we should try and embrace that a little bit.
Of course, we all know what happened to that Silicon Valley ethos.
Well, hey, you know what? Everybody likes to gamble a little bit.
So far, it's been a good gamble. Other big agencies are dipping into digital representation every day. Creative Artists Agency has signed the people behind a wildly successful web series called The Berg. William Morris is online, too. But analyst Hal Vogel says it's going to take more than that to get the concept of online talent agents to go viral.
I always look for adult supervision in any kind of structures that are new and different and require a little bit of gray hair on the top of the head.
The guys at UTA think it's because they are so young that they've been able to pick as many winners as they have, never mind what the old guys think.
If all those 54-year-olds sat down with their 17-year-old kids for a week and said, show me what you do.
Is part of your job getting them to do that, to sit down and say, I need to understand this?
Either way, they're going to have to learn if they want to keep their jobs.
You can decide for yourselves whether Nadler and the crew at UTA Online are doing their jobs. The production team behind Prom Queen is launching a new web series today. It's another murder mystery called Foreign Body. We'll have the links on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, which may or may not help the real estate business out of its current crunch, but it will definitely help those who shop for homes online. The Justice Department and the National Association of Realtors announced a deal today in an antitrust lawsuit. The upshot is that more home listings are going to be available on the web through something known as the Multiple Listing Service. It'll be a boost for those retailers who do work only online, and for buyers, too, who should probably be able to save a couple of percentage points on their commissions. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 68 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ added 36 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 hiked up 9 points. That's 0.2% there. The credits today are short. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, paying to capture your life on film.
It is your legacy. It's what you are leaving behind.
So I could just leave a whole bunch of lies.
Absolutely.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.